Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to the 28th edition of Risky Business, right here on itradio.com.au. We've got some good news for listeners. We've done a bit of work on the site and you can now subscribe to this podcast via email. Click on the link that says subscribe to weekly email podcast updates and we will send you a weekly email with a summary of the show and a link to the podcast you've subscribed to. Don't forget, IT Radio publishes two podcasts each week, Risky Business and a series of Tubes with Ian Yates, our networking show, which usually updates on Thursdays. We'll be offering some prizes soon for new subscribers, so get in there for your chance to win some goodies later this year. We added the email subscriptions for all the people stuck in Windows land on corporate networks run by fascists who don't allow RSS podcatchers or iTunes on their desktops. We've got an interesting feature interview this week. We'll be catching up with Dmitry Vitaliev. Many listeners will be fascinated by Dmitry's work in the area of information security and human rights. He trains those fighting for human rights in all sorts of god-awful dictatorships on how to outfox government monitoring and censorship. He'll also tell us how you can help. We'll of course check in with our sponsor Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust, for our weekly sponsor interview. This week we're talking to Robert Lording. He's the Internal Security Manager with Verizon Business Security Solutions. Surely a job that would make any sensible person completely paranoid. Yes, they are out to get him. Security companies make prime targets. He'll be along later. Now, normally we'd check in with Munir Katadia at ZDNet Australia for this week's news, but he's off in a series of meetings today. It's what happens when you get promoted to the ranks of editor. But Age and Sydney Morning Herald columnist and freelance journalist Adam Turner is here in his place to discuss the week's major happenings. Adam, our first news item begs the question, is a choice of operating system a human right?
Well, that's something I never really thought about before today, but you've probably got a good point there. I thought perhaps when I first read it that using Windows was part of his punishment.
As it turns out, a movie pirate based in the United States has been told that he has to use Windows as part of his parole conditions because the government has mandated that he must use surveillance software on his system and it won't run on Linux. And this guy, of course, is a big Linux boffin and he's a little bit upset.
Maybe he should ask to go back to jail where they've got better computers or something. That's ridiculous.
So apparently, he got busted uploading one of the Star Wars movies. I mean, yeah. He wound up spending 5 months in prison for that, which is pretty hardcore by Australian standards, for uploading Star Wars Episode 3. And as a result, he was sentenced to 5 months in jail and 5 months home confinement, according to ZDNet Australia. And he goes by the name of Scott, and I just love this quote. He told me that if I wanted to use a computer, I would have to use an OS that the software can be installed on, which basically means Microsoft and monitoring software or no computer. I use Ubuntu now, and they are trying to force me to switch. First, they gave me two felonies, then they throw me in prison, and now this. He makes it sound like it's as bad as the felony convictions.
Well, it depends how you want to look at it. Some people take their operating systems very seriously. But, I mean, he's lucky, like, look at what they did to Mitnick. It's not exactly the same thing, but he wasn't allowed to basically use a computer at all, I think.
Well, Mitnick was on the lam for 2 years, on an FBI list. He didn't just upload Star Wars Episode 3.
My point is that they've given this guy an option. They said to him, look, we'll let you use a computer as long as it's a Windows computer and we can monitor it. They could have just said to him, you can't use the internet for a year.
Yeah, I think the verdict is that he's a whinger.
Yeah. He's a bit unlucky, but really he got off lightly when they could have just basically thrown him back in jail or said, right, I'm sorry, but you're back to using postcards for 12 months. No email for you.
Well, I think we're prepared. Are you prepared to call it? Because I am. I think choice of operating system is not a basic human right.
No, not yet.
No need to notify Amnesty International just yet.
No, I don't think there'll be a million-man march over that one.
Okay, cool. Now, this isn't such a security-related story, but it goes to the argument of integrity on the internet. We've had John Howard and Peter Costello's teams being quite busy on Wikipedia of late.
Does this really come as a surprise to anybody, though?
Well, this is what I wonder, really, because Wikipedia is the encyclopedia that anyone can edit. And, of course, there's
people out there with the resources to spend time editing entries. And we've got, you know, a reference to Peter Costello being named Captain Smirk.
Remember, they're using public servants to do this. That's the worst thing about
now,
it.
That is the angle that makes this newsworthy as far as I'm concerned. They're not Liberal Party stuff. They're taxpayer-funded stuff. But then again, you would imagine that people who work for the Prime Minister would perhaps be the ones best placed to correct entries or at least be tempted to correct entries. It's just really a question of whether or not they were acting on orders, isn't
it? But you have to be pretty naive to think that this kind of stuff wasn't happening. Although I doubt it was little Johnny's idea because I doubt he knows what Wikipedia is. This stuff happens all the time. You have to be naive to think that this stuff's not going on.
Mm.
One of the interesting things, though, and the same is when they were talking about in the US about the edits that the CIA were doing to Wikipedia. Sure, some of them were trying to, you know, maybe cover up black ops or change things they didn't quite like, but a lot of them were to do with, like, episode guides from Buffy and stuff like that.
Well, that's the other thing, too. Apparently, the single biggest block of IPs that's responsible for editing Wikipedia within Australia is actually the Australian Defence Force, the Department of Defence. Really, when you look at the actual edits they've made, most of them are to do with things of military history, and you can imagine there would be, you know, most of your military history boffins, the largest concentration of them, are going to work for the Department of Defence.
But they're not necessarily doing that as part of their job. They're doing that over a sandwich at lunchtime.
Once again, interesting story. So don't necessarily believe everything you read on Wikipedia. I believe PR companies are now sort of spruiking their ability to manage things like Wikipedia entries on their clients.
I'm sure they are. They'd be crazy if they're not.
Yeah, so I really think it's just a matter of time before it's been completely subverted. But look, moving on, we've got another actual security story here, which is licensing issues have delayed Symantec's vPro solution.
Yeah, DedNet Australia reported that they've delayed it due to licensing conditions around Windows CE.
This is hilarious, okay, because vPro is designed to be this virtualized stack, okay? So instead of running your security software on top of your operating system, you're basically running it in parallel, which, you know, look, I don't know that it's a particularly revolutionary idea. It sounds like a pretty good idea because it will stop, well, it has potential to stop these rootkits which install themselves as a virtualization layer. So actually having a security suite that runs in parallel next to the operating system but doesn't rely on the operating system to report, you know, accurately things to it, good idea.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, there's probably still going to be vulnerabilities in that software, and it will be perfectly possible to own the security software, even if it's running in its own little sandboxed virtualized environment. So it looks like they're using Windows CE for that stack, and the licensing when it comes to virtualized platforms are a little vague. So it seems a shame to have a piece of technology held back for that. But virtualization really has come out of nowhere over the last couple of years. It's technology that's been around for a while, but wow, VMware and ZenSource and now Microsoft jumping in, it really is going gangbusters, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. But it still surprises me that licensing issues about virtualization have been around for a long time.
Mm.
So the fact that they're still arguing about it now is maybe a sign that there's something else going on.
Who would have thought to do virtualization licensing on a compact edition of Windows, though? I mean, this is the thing. We're finding so many more applications. We're developing more applications for virtualized environments than we can think of at the moment.
Mm.
So I think, you know, maybe that's where the licensing problems fall down. Interesting idea for technology, and I'm looking forward to having a play with it. Now, it's been all over the news the last couple of weeks, but can you believe the amount of ink that all things Facebook are generating at the moment, Adam?
I must be the only guy in the world who doesn't get Facebook.
You don't get it?
I understand what it is, and I'm on it because someone invited me and I felt it was impolite to say no, but it just seems to be this huge dating site. Like, I understand the point of LinkedIn. I don't understand the point of Facebook, but maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm in a minority.
Well, look, you might not understand it, but apparently business fears it because a survey from Sophos found that 50% of firms are actually restricting employees' access due to concerns about productivity and security. Now, I think this is quite funny because I don't see how Facebook is any more dangerous than any other website on the planet.
No, it's just because it gets itself in the papers and everybody go, oh, we'll make it look like we're doing something. We'll block Facebook to make it look like we're being proactive and following what's happening.
Well, interesting, isn't it, that Sophos's press release on this came a short time after Surf Control scored global press by suggesting that Facebook was costing Australian firms $5 billion annually in lost productivity.
Facebook stole my baby.
Well, I just wrote an opinion piece for Tech Target Australia and New Zealand called Facebook is impurifying our bodily fluids, Mandrake.
Pretty much the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a lot of paranoia out there about it. As I sort of pointed out in the piece, you know, while some organisations are saying that, you know, people are slacking off on Facebook, I mean, before it was Facebook, it was IM. Before it was IM, it was email. And before it was email, it was solitaire. And before that, people would just stare into middle distance for hours on end,
pretending to do something when they weren't.
That's right. It looks like they're working. So
I was amazed, though, when I joined Facebook about the amount of information that it asked me for and that people would be crazy enough to hand it over. And the thing that really knocked me off my chair was when it asked me for my email address password so it could check my email account to see if it knew people in my address book. Think how many sites, who would you trust if some other site said to me, oh, just tell me the password to your email address. It's okay. I won't use it. Just tell it to me. Like, that just screams phishing site to me. But people do it.
It does, but we know that Facebook's not a phishing site, you know? I mean, perhaps what's more scary is that people are out there displaying, you know, their hometown, address, phone number, and date of birth. Why on earth does Facebook allow its users to display date of birth? I think I also wrote in this piece that, thank God, there's no field for mother's maiden name.
Exactly.
And name of first pet cat.
I mean, the only thing better than getting all that thing off Facebook is actually stealing someone's resume. It's as good as the same thing. You're basically handing every piece of information that someone needs to you to steal your identity to them on a plate.
Well, it's funny you should mention that because Monster.com, it turns out that there's been a Trojan unleashed in the United States designed specifically to steal Monster.com logins, and then it's actually crawling in, grabbing people's sensitive information and compiling it in a central repository. So online resume stores are becoming a really attractive target for ID thieves, and they're using that information to send job offers, basically, to these people whose details have been snuffed off the site. And really, they're not job offers. They're part of a, you know, multi-pronged scam. But
it's genius, though. I mean, I don't know why they didn't think of it sooner. That's these kind of places, whether it be Facebook or Monster.com, where there are all these, where you give them more information than you ever give anyone else, are just prime targets. Because, like I said, you get that information, and as your job's basically already done.
Yeah. Okay, Adam. Well, thanks a lot for filling in for Munir this week, mate. Much appreciated.
That's all right. Thanks for giving me the chance to be on.
That was Adam Turner there with this week's news, filling in for Munir Katadia. We'll be right back after this.
Struggling to manage and protect your branch office networks? Juniper Networks offers a range of security and networking solutions to help you deploy high-performance, secure branch office networks. Contact Juniper on 1300 458 647 or visit us at juniper.net.
Our next guest is Dmitry Vitaliev, or Vitaliev, or I really don't know how to pronounce it. Dmitry, who now lives in Canada, is an Australian by passport but Russian by birth. Some years ago, he dropped out of an IT program at Swinburne University in Melbourne after 2 years. While he was at uni, he'd worked at a small investment bank run out of Collins Street and as a teacher at 4th R Computer School. He eventually wound up in Amsterdam working at AT&T as a system administrator. But when Dmitry went to Ireland to see a Rolling Stones concert, he ended up volunteering to work at a human rights conference in Dublin, organised by Frontline, a group committed to defending the rights of human rights activists around the world. Well, it shook him up, and he stayed working at Frontline as the Russian researcher and sysadmin. He realised activists needed to know about computer security. So many had been affected by targeted digital attacks, surveillance, and censorship. So that's what he does now. He also manages NGO in a Box, a free open source collection of tools that NGOs can use to protect themselves against government attacks. Dmitry spoke to me via voice over IP from Canada.
At the moment, I'm a consultant on issues of digital security and privacy. Most of the time, I'm consulting to NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and specifically to human rights NGOs and human rights activists who are operating in oppressive and totalitarian regimes. It starts from the very basic on teaching them basically about computers, computer operations, internet operations, and then where it is that they could meet with different types of insecurities. Now, these are common insecurities that we all meet on the internet, perhaps, such as viruses, hackers, and so on. To the more specific insecurities aimed at where it is that they operate and live, such as website censorship, internet surveillance, keyword filtering, computer confiscation, theft, and so on.
So
many of these people do operate in a very restricted, not only political, but also internet environment. Very often their emails are read, sometimes misdirected or redirected. Sometimes emails are spoofed, as in somebody writes on their behalf saying some sort of damaging information.
So, yeah, that was my next question. What sort of dirty tricks do totalitarian regimes use against human rights activists on the internet?
Quite a few, actually. For instance, when I was in Tunisia a little while back, working with a local human rights group, they said that they couldn't get onto the internet. They'd call up the ISP, and the ISP said that there'd be no problem, the connection is working fine, and that the modem dialed in and everything was fine, but the internet would never come on. So after a little bit of looking around, I mean, their computer was quite messy, and like most people who don't really, who just use computers for their work without knowing so much about it. But I installed a simple firewall, and as soon as the firewall was engaged, it noticed that the ISP was sending them a reset packet as soon as they were connecting. Basically, as soon as they were connecting, they would disconnect them itself. And this was done by a worm which was placed in the computer beforehand.
And you believe that was placed there maybe by...
prevented the reset packet from coming in, and they were able to use the internet.
So you believe that might have been the result of government intervention?
It may have been. In Tunisia, there is only one really national provider, and very often these groups are targeted in many different ways. And even though, of course, this could have been a fault, usually when these type of events occur, one would put two and two together and say that this is possibly, you know, a result of particular action on behalf of whoever that might be, the Ministry of Communication, the local police force, the local businessmen, and so on.
So
being
is there,
able to pressure the ISP.
Is there an instance that you can think of where you found a smoking gun of government intervention on a human rights campaigner's machine?
Well, of course. I mean, there are quite well-known cases in China, for instance, where China was able to pressure Yahoo and other companies, but I'll concentrate on Yahoo here, into revealing access to some of the users' email boxes. Now, these users in particular were democracy activists. Yahoo opened up the accounts to the Chinese authorities, and these people were put in prison. Later on, some of my colleagues as well were able to pinpoint that it was specifically made, that the only way this could have occurred is that the Yahoo account was sent over to the Chinese government. I guess that's one smoking gun. When governments outright block certain websites from access to their population, this, of course, as well, you know, is a very clear statement of what it is they would like and would not like their people to see.
So really you see the most of the activity being around preventing these people from being able to have freedom of expression online?
Yes, that's definitely some of their activities. It is as though the current political state that these people live in, political regime, is also moved onto the digital realm. So you can, you know, the media is censored in the country. People are not allowed to speak freely. All of a sudden, the internet comes in. Everyone has a global voice, and many regimes cannot survive with such flows of information, and so they begin to restrict them as well.
So what is it that you teach human rights activists to do? Do you teach them about covert communications? Do you teach them about how to effectively anonymize themselves on the internet?
Yes, as well. As I said before, I teach them the basics. Then, you know, we do teach technology that performs different types of circumvention activity, bypassing different internet blocks and so on. Teach them about, you know, the HTTPS layer. Teach them about anonymity. Teach them about how to encrypt their hard drives or how to destroy information properly from a hard drive in the case of computer confiscation and so on.
And what do you recommend in that case? Is it Thermite or is it something a little more sophisticated?
In which case?
In the case of preventing authorities from being able to read data off a confiscated hard drive.
There's a number of steps. And I guess the thing that I try and get across in the projects that I do and in the publications which I write is that you should have a bag full of tricks, and it should be really a process. Security is a process, not just one solution that you install this program and it takes care of everything for you. And I also try and concentrate on software which is open source. The kind of mentality of open source is very interlinked with the mentality of human rights movement. So, you know, in these cases, I would recommend a program like Eraser to be able to wipe a specific amount of data, as well as the swap file, as well as the different sort of hanging of clusters which may occur, and also to use a metadata wiper, maybe one like CCleaner that's able to go through all of your temporary files and
what about,
also get rid of them permanently.
What about technologies like, you know, full disk encryption products and, you know, more specifically BitLocker from, you know, Microsoft? Has your group approached any commercial software makers to try to get them to provide their products to your project?
For free?
Yeah.
I have approached a few organizations. It very rarely turns out to be so. Because not only do we distribute our products, but we also encourage people to continue distributing them. So it would be very hard to give us a license for 100, because we encourage people, after we train them, to go back into their constituency and train others and pass on this software and so on.
So that's what makes the open source factor important, is that it's a tool that is infinitely replicable among the people who need it.
Yes, as well. That's one of the,
okay,
one of the factors.
So what sort of activists have you been helping out specifically? Just human rights and democracy campaigners in totalitarian regimes? Or
quite a lot of LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual groups.
Mm. There's a great deal of persecution in some countries for gay and lesbians?
Yes, especially, you know, especially in Eastern Africa, in the Middle East, in a few of the countries in Asia.
Mm.
Definitely so. People who are doing impact assessment of corporate maneuvering in their region, you know, building mines, taking over water supplies. There are many human rights campaigners involved with those issues. You know, pretty much all issues you could think of that relate to one of the 30 or so declarations, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that people do continually strive to adhere to, or to make others adhere to. You know, I have probably worked with them.
So what can Risky Business listeners do to help?
Well, I assume that your listeners out there, you know, are tech interested or tech savvy. So perhaps there are programmers out there, there are developers out there. There are some general things I would say, like when you do develop software, to think globally, you know, to either implement the interfaces in multiple languages, or to make it easier for others to perhaps translate the software, because so much software out there is kind of elitist in its approach that you need to understand English or Spanish, let's say, before you can use it. So to think globally when developing software.
Mm.
Then to be able to possibly install some of the services that many of these people operating in oppressive regimes rely on, such as Tor service. The Tor network is a global anonymity network that continually improves as the number of Tor servers grow. Another product came out recently called Siphon, and this is basically, you know, an ability to build a proxy in your computer and then allow people in these countries to use your computer as a proxy out to the internet. Mm. So there are many different issues with this. But if people are interested in finding out, perhaps they can contact myself, and through me, a lot of my colleagues out there. Is a simple email address, which is security@ngolinabox.org.
Okay, and you guys yourselves are a not-for-profit?
Yes. It's actually myself, you know, as I said, I work with a group called the Tactical Technology Collective. It's a non-profit, but I also consult for quite a few other non-profits.
Okay, well, Dimitri, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
Okay, Patrick, thanks a lot.
That was Dimitri Vitaliev there. He's also written a book about his craft, and you can find the link on the IT Radio website.
Oh, and on another note, when discussing the Tunisian incident, he made reference to the discovery of a worm on the human rights activist's system. He, of course, meant to say malware. Now it's time for our sponsor interview. As regular listeners know, this podcast is sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust. Each week, we get one of the company's experts on the show to have a chat. And this week, it's Robert Lording. He's Verizon Business Security Solutions Head of Internal Security for Asia Pacific, or as his business card reads, Asia Pacific Group Manager, Network and Information Security. So, has Lording's job made him freakishly paranoid?
You could say that. You could say that. I've been in this game now for, well, between security and in a major corporate and from law enforcement background for some 20 years. So I've seen threats come and go. I suppose rather than paranoid, I think you'd probably say that we're conscious and we're aware of the potential for new security vulnerabilities to emerge all the time.
Yeah. Now, I mean, what extra responsibilities come with locking down an organization such as Verizon Business Security Solutions? Because, you know, you're in the market out there saying, hey, let us help you secure your system. So obviously it'd be a disaster if you guys got owned.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, you know, that's one of the interesting things here is that, you know, in terms of the job that I have, I am, you know, focused primarily on delivering security within our organization. We can't sell security products to customers unless we have a reputation for, you know, delivering on the services to them, but also that they have a level of faith or trust in us that our back end networks and the products and solutions that we're delivering are going to be secure as well.
Does that mean that you have to be a complete fascist when it comes to regulating user behavior? Because I imagine there's a lot of people who work for the company who aren't actually security practitioners. There'd be your accounts people and
Absolutely.
Your HR people.
Absolutely. Well, I think this is the issue that we, in fact, security practitioners in all companies need to address, is that there are going to be users who have different levels of security awareness. And the other thing, probably more importantly, is that there are people within the organisation who are going to be dealing with information of different levels of sensitivity. I think that a single approach where we try and treat every user at the same level is actually a mistake. It's very important for me and for the people in our organisation to recognise the levels that we've got to apply for different types of information, and the levels that need to be applied based on the types of role. So while we implement security measures, say, for laptops or for portable devices, are fairly consistent across the board in terms of what goes out, we also need to take a lot of other steps to ensure that that access to the information and the availability of information for particular critical areas are subject of greater protection.
So it's really about the need to know military style of, you know, appropriating access to information.
Absolutely. I think, well, on that side, yes, one aspect is need to know, and certainly we shouldn't make information available to everybody, but it's also a matter of looking at the information itself and determining what sort of risk are we prepared to accept for particular types of information. So, you know, does a customer list need to be more highly protected than the credit card details associated with an individual customer? You know, I think there's more than enough evidence to suggest that some banks have had some difficulties in protecting credit card information. And the issue there is that, you know, the damage reputationally to our company and financially to our customers in the event that that type of information got out, would be quite high. Whereas, you know, if we had other types of information, you know, the name, the address of a particular customer is certainly less sensitive.
That was Robert Lording there from our sponsor, Verizon Business Security Solutions, discussing his efforts in locking down the business's own network. He'll be back next week to discuss the role of ISPs and backbone providers in tackling the spread of network worms. And that's it for this week's installment of Risky Business. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.